If you were to take a look or a listen around and just try to observe what are the worldviews that are driving the way that Americans see the world? What are the worldviews that are driving the way Americans interpret and see and function in the world? There's a few. One of the main ones is called secular humanism. Then there is a variety of what could be called spiritualism. There is also a whole different category called New Age or New Age beliefs. For most people, along with those worldviews, their view on the world and their interpretation of their own experiences is based on and largely influenced by their background, their family background, ethnic background, their cultural background, what region. Did you know that a lot of the way you see the world is developed based on what region you live in? Did you know that? Take a visit down south, and some people I know personally have gone down south, and short time thereafter come back home, and they say things like, "I just didn't get comfortable there." There is a shaping influence of what region of the country that you're in, and also your education and your religious background. So you put all those things together, and there is a formation that's occurring that causes us to see the world a certain way. And if you were to drop in on an app like ChatGPT, I made a visit to ChatGPT for your sake. I'm sure you're thrilled to know that your pastor prepares his Sunday messages with AI. Are you relieved? Oh, there they go, right out the door. Did you see that? There's a whole family. Big old Bible, out they went. So you ask ChatGPT a question like this: how should I treat people? What you're going to get in AI is you're going to get this particular app is going to it's going to scrape the World Wide Web. It's going to scrape information that is essentially that exists, the data that exists, and it is going to scrape for the quality data that's out there that might be best practices or most widely accepted or advocated for data, and it's going to create new content. And that new content essentially reflects the most widely accepted accurate information. So I'm intrigued to find out what does ChatGPT scrape from the World Wide Web and then tell me how to treat people? Wouldn't this be fun? Let's see what it says. Here's what ChatGPT said: treat people with kindness, respect, and empathy. Listen actively. Be considerate of their feelings and perspectives, and strive to understand them without your judgment. Now, how many of you would say you've heard this before? Would you raise your hand if you've told someone this, or someone's told you this? Or raise your hand if you thought, this is fair. I've heard that. I've been told that, right? This is not far out. This isn't coming from some unique perspective that we've never heard before. But I do wonder, where's the Christian worldview in this? And for those of you who are suspicious of ChatGPT and other AI, as you should be, I too was wondering, am I going to get any Christian perspective in this? Are we going to see anything advanced that comes from my worldview in the Bible? Well, good news. At the bottom, last sentence, look at this one. Treat others as you would like to be treated yourself. Now, this isn't from some philosophy reference book. This isn't from some textbook in school. This isn't from a counseling theory that is advanced by academics. Here's good news, that ChatGPT included something that Jesus said in its answer. I think that's pretty good news. How to treat people is described here, and what you're seeing here is essentially something called the golden rule. The golden rule. Treat people the way that you want to be treated. And again, I'm kind of relieved and thrilled to tell you that this doesn't come from the internet. This isn't coming from the World Wide Web. This is actually something that Jesus tells us. And in the Sermon on the Mount, he puts a couple of expectations together that are life-altering, and they are two of life's most important questions he answers as to how to live a meaningful life. This is so good for you if you're looking for ways to make your life more meaningful. This is so good for your family if you're trying to teach your kids how to live a more meaningful life. This is so good for those of you that maybe are suffering with some kind of purposelessness, or maybe you're suffering from aimlessness and you just don't know how quite to kind of dial in and what to focus on. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, answers two of life's most meaningful questions. How do I treat people? What am I supposed to do with this person and that person? What am I supposed to do with this family member and this coworker? What am I supposed to do with my spouse, my kids? What am I supposed to do with them? How am I supposed to treat them? And secondly, he answers the question, which path in my life am I supposed to be taking? Which path am I supposed to be taking? Now, if you have a high school graduate in your home and they're trying to discern their lifelong career path at 18 years old, that's intense, isn't it? That's intense. But Jesus here actually answers that question, and he answers the question, what path should I take in my life? Not by pointing out which vocation is the most valuable and meaningful in the world, but how do I choose a way to live? Which direction should I go? And if and when you're with Jesus, like we are here today, he spells it out. He spells it out. It's so impossible to miss. And he wanted to make sure that his disciples, listening to his very first sermon as the new and better Moses, didn't miss. How should I treat people? Which direction am I supposed to go in my life? What path should my life go, and how do I get there? And here's what Jesus said, in my kingdom, I expect my disciples to choose a new rule and a narrow path. And the new rule is actually not a new rule, it's actually the summation, it's in essence the rules that had been kept and enforced by the Jewish people that had come from God and Moses in the Old Testament. How does Jesus expect his disciples to treat people? Let's start there. How does Jesus expect his disciples to treat people? When Jesus says, you belong to me, and if you're in me, and I'm with you, and you trust me, and you're following me, I've saved your soul, and I'm going to sanctify your behavior, I'm going to bring newness to your life, and we're going to start with, let's treat people a certain way. Let's treat people a specific way. If you want to live with me, you're going to live a life that's salty, and you're going to live a life that's bright. So in the darkness, you're going to shine bright with contrast, and in the blandness of the world, you're going to be salty. And Jesus narrows this down into one crucial life rule. How do you treat your people? If you've got aging parents, how do you treat them? If you've got adult kids, how do you treat them? If you got coworkers, how do you treat them? Teammates, classmates, how do you treat those people? If you have misbehaving children, how do you treat them? If you have prideful family members, what am I supposed to do with them? When do I finally tell them what I've always thought of them? If you've got needy or naughty neighbors, Jesus tells us how to treat them. If you have an insecure boss or disrespectful classmates or coworkers, Jesus couldn't make it any clearer. He's so clear with us. How do we treat those people? Look what he says. Follow the new rule. Let this new rule guide the way that you interact and deal with these people that are in your life. Let this new rule guide you. I'm curious, how many of you generally have a rule for life? Anybody have a rule for life you inherited from your parents? Would you raise your hand if you've got some rules for life that guide how you... I'll give you an example. How many of you have the rule in your life, spend less than you earn? Anybody? Is that a rule for life? Well, there's not very many of you. Goodness gracious. I mean, almost nobody. There are rules that drive us life, and Jesus is passing on these rules, and he's actually not providing a new rule. He's actually summarizing the Old Testament law that was given, and you can even see this, that Jesus is dealing with a very similar way that the law provided in the Old Testament. The law basically said this. If you have difficult people in your life and you're in conflict with those people, then an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye. Have you heard that before? An eye for an eye. What does that mean? Well, that essentially means that make sure that your retribution is proportionate. Meaning, however it is that somebody wronged you or dealt with you, make sure that when you retaliate that it's in proportion. Assess whatever they did to you and make your revenge or your retribution similar. And this was, in large part, this was a confrontation that God was bringing to the Jewish people, saying, hey, calm down. When someone offends you, don't set their home on fire. Let's not go overboard here and ruin people's lives who've just embarrassed you or put you off or violated your pride or somehow maybe they stole something from you and you don't have entitlement. If you are one of my people, you are not entitled to wipe out their livestock. So this law comes down that you should treat them an eye for an eye. Don't over-avenge your losses, but it's fair to retaliate. I couldn't help but think of a late night visit while I was in college with some of my college friends. And they have the equivalent of a TJ's Big Boy down there, but it's not TJ's. Bob's Big Boy, maybe, down south. Anyone from down south remember the Big Boy name? Not Shelby's. That's a car. So late one night, my friends and I are eating, and the server is serving our table, and when we were leaving, I looked around the table for a tip, because I'm with my college friends, and we have to make sure that someone's got to take responsibility for the tip. And I noticed about a dollar or so on the tip, and immediately thought, I got to run to the car. I don't have any cash on me. I got to run to the car and get a tip. So on my way back in with the tip money, all of my friends are at the front door of the restaurant. And the server leans his head around the corner of the kitchen, and he says, hey, thanks for the tip. And I'm a pretty laid-back guy. I'm not easily offended. I'm pretty laid-back. I don't tend to overreact to things, but something about that little sarcasm, something really set me off. And I said to them, in essence, I said, hey, hold on, buddy. Can you give us more than a minute to gather up some cash for tip? Can you give us a minute? Are you eager to get home? God, leave us, ease up. And my friends kind of stepped back and like split the Red Sea and looked at me and left me isolated by myself in the middle. And I'm looking around like I had just gotten in an alley street fight. And they're like, well, calm down. What's the matter with you? I said, did you hear that guy? What's his problem? He didn't give us any time to go get a tip. We're not even out of the restaurant yet, and I'm not even sure we've squared the bill away yet. Good gracious. That guy's got to calm down. I went from 0 to 100 in about 3 seconds. And it was disturbing to my friends, this unrecognizable response. Meanwhile, they are trying to tell me, what's wrong with you? And I said, you hear him sarcastically, basically mocking us? Hey, thanks for the tip. Look at us. Obviously, we're poor, we're scrounging it up. Maybe we went out to work a couple hours, come back with the cash. Clearly, and they said, dude, you don't be an idiot. We left him $20. He's thanking us for the tip. So I also forgot, he can't be sarcastic. There's no sarcasm in Oklahoma. I brought that with me from New York. He's not being sarcastic with me. He's literally saying, thanks for the tip. He got a $20 tip. Do you remember 1992 what $20 would be? That's right, $10,000, exactly. You remember exactly right. So in essence here, I am functioning like a lot of us do. You get a little sarcasm, and what are you giving back? A little bit of sarcasm. You get a little bit of offense, and what do you do back? Give a little bit of offense. You get a hard time from your coworker or your boss, what do? Give them a hard time back. Your family member that is giving you a little cold shoulder and distance, oh, that's an easy one. How would you like the little distance and cold shoulder? How do you like it? This is a functional operating position for most of us as Americans and human beings, and also at the same time still can fall under the Old Testament law, which is an eye for an eye. If you get a little sarcasm, chop them in the throat a little bit. A little eye poke, verbally. And Jesus is saying, when you belong to me, when you're following me, my people are not bringing flavor and brightness, contrast to the world by treating people like that. There's a new way to treat people. There's a new law. And this new law is, in essence, the summation of the law of God, which was hundreds of, at the time, they had kind of taken these laws. The Pharisees had taken the laws and generated even more, but God had delivered this, this law, and Jesus says, the heart of the law, if you do this, if you follow this rule, the heart of the law is achieved. In essence, here's how it's achieved. Do to others whatever you would like them to do to you. This is the essence of all that is taught in the law and the prophets. If you want to kind of live according to God's law, which we do as we belong to Jesus, we simply do this. We live by this high standard of treating people the way that we would want to be treated, which is different from treating people the way that they are treating us, right? This is profoundly different. This is life-altering. This changes everything for each of us. When we think about the high standard that this is. Why? Because most of us are pretty good to ourselves, right? There's a philosophy that has kind of overcome us in our culture, which is self-love, self-care, and I believe sometimes it means be healthy. Make sure you're healthy before you're trying to do all this, that for other people. And then at other times, I feel like it's more like overindulgent catering to oneself because you're the center of the universe, right? Depends on how that's applied. But self-love is a powerful force in our lives. It drives a lot of what we do, right? I don't know about you, but what drives me is getting comfortable and getting convenience. Drives so much of the way I function. It must also drive us in our behavior toward other people. The way that we care for ourselves, now Jesus said, this is what's going to be driving your care for other people. And Jesus' statement is massively helpful. From a life coaching perspective, in almost every relational circumstance, this one will change your life. This one will bring you so much life. Imagine, this is all you have to do. Imagine how you want to be treated. Just picture it. Describe it. Write it down. Make a little list. How do I want to be treated? And then you look at that list and you say, this is how I'm moving forward. This is how I'm going to reach out to this person. This is how I'm going to communicate to them. How would I like to be treated in that situation? This comes to life for me when I think about my life as a Sunday preacher. Here's how it comes to life for me. I, for one, when I am listening to somebody preach or teach on a platform very similar to this setting here, I, for one, don't receive a certain tone very well. It's very, very difficult for me to receive from a preacher who is treating me or the listeners like they're holier than everybody else, or that they're righteous and now they're trying to scold the unrighteous listeners. Or I don't receive very well from a preacher, teacher who has a tone that I can easily or maybe interpret as angry, right? The whole time, I'm just thinking to myself, just, okay, calm down. There's no reason to be angry at me. Or that that somehow this particular speaker, preacher, teacher seems like they're kind of playing a character in a drama solo. And the character is, okay, you're going to go out there, and for X amount of time, I want you to play the role of a preacher. And then there's this very off-putting tone or character that kind of snaps in. I, for one, don't hear that well, very well from that type of approach. And so I oftentimes think to myself, if this is a hard truth or this is a challenging truth or just in general, if you're going to make this presentation, think about what it is that you like, you prefer. How is it that the teacher, preacher speaks to you in a certain way that you don't like, and how do you receive it well? And it generates, it helps me address and inspect, what's my tone like? Do I sound condescending, self-righteous? Am I scolding people who are no different than me? Are we learning together, or do I have something in my high and mighty spiritual brain and in my piousness I'm trying to kind of roll out to the peasants to learn and listen? Am I having a conversation with people who are smart, who are thinking, who deserve respect, and who are being challenged to come along and discover and learn together? Or am I somehow adopting someone else's style, someone else's persona and personality? Am I doing it like someone else? Am I speaking, joking, acting like myself? And that informs how I treat listeners, just thinking through this very simple thing. What would you like them to do? Do to others. Speak, share, interact, inspire, talk to, teach, and preach other people the way that you receive it yourself. And that does a lot of interesting steering on how things are presented or how things are laid out. So if you really, really like to be respected, if respect is your thing, maybe you don't always have to be loved, maybe you don't always have to be honored and celebrated, maybe you don't always have to be one thing or other, but you need to be respected, then there are times when we should hear ourselves say something, express something, maybe out loud in our head, and we think things like, my Republican friend, what an idiot, what a dope, what a whatever words you like, ninny, my Democrat coworker, boss, whatever, what an absolute fool. Get this, we are breaking the basic one starting point rule that we treat someone else the way that we would want to be treated. And I don't know about you, but it would not land well to have someone who's on a political spectrum that's on the other side of the aisle, the other side of the tracks, the other side of the worldview, philosophy, or whatever, looking at my view and looking at me and referencing me as idiot, whatever. And so who takes responsibility to change the tone? Who takes responsibility to change the way people are treated? You might want to be, after all these years, you know somebody and you're just kind of wondering, hoping, wishing, praying at times, why won't they forgive me? Be eager to forgive. You might be in the setting in your life, the phase of your life where you need rent. You need groceries. You need a mental health day. You need someone to pray for you. You need a good listener. Give that to someone else. Be the person. Make the generous, open-handed gift. Do the listening. Be the one who is eager to be generous. If you're married and you've ever caught yourself saying or thinking, it's not too much to ask. Just a little bit of understanding. Just understand. Stop being so defensive. Stop running from this. Stop the attacking. I just need some understanding. Here's what Jesus says. Be the first to do the work to understand. Take the time to ask better questions and hang in there, and you work to understand them. Why can't she ever believe in me? Believe in her. Why are they trying to change me? Why is my spouse selected me as their life work, their life project to change me? Receive your spouse the way they are. Start there. Receive who you're married to, who God gave you to. Receive them exactly the way they are. Well, they don't respect me. Here's a question. Are you telling them how much their opinions and their input matters to you? And what this does is, this, what Jesus is doing is saying, Jesus is challenging us, and he gives us the power to focus on ourselves instead of on someone else. We focus on our behavior, we focus on our attitude, we focus on our response, and we focus on how we treat people. And he even says, you can think about yourself, but all you're thinking is, how do I want to be treated? And this is a challenging turn of events that happens. And even if your parents, this is challenging, right? Even if your parents, do you like it when your adult kids try to control you? Let go of control over them. That's where we start. Let go of control over them. Kids, do you like it when your parents listen to you? Listen to them with both your ears and your heart. Give them your heart. Put in context what they've been saying to you. Put in context their life experience. Put in context their background and where they came from and how they were raised. Try to understand the full meaning of what they're sharing with you as your parent, as you say, I've got both ears going, I have shut down my one mouth, and I am giving it all I can to understand their heart's intentions. That'll dramatically change your relationship with your parents. Dramatically. If you're a boss, I don't know if you remember not being a boss. I don't know if you remember being an employee or being on a team or not necessarily being the business boss or the business owner. But do you remember how thrilling it was to be motivated by guilt at work? Do you remember how thrilling it was? Do you remember how much you loved just being offered more hours, more and being offered, guilted into more hours and guilted into more pay? Of course not. Of course not. But you probably remember what it was like to be motivated by the boss with affirmation, encouragement, positive feedback, coaching conversations, getting a little bit of honor and trust. And then as a boss, you say, I remember what it was like when I was an employee and the way I needed to be treated. This is what Jesus is putting in front of me. Treat my employees the way that I wanted to be treated when I was one myself. If we stopped and asked ourselves seriously, how would I like to be treated in that situation? We would be never condescending, always humble, never harsh, just understanding, always understanding. And if we asked ourselves sincerely how I would like to be treated in that situation, we wouldn't be cruel, we'd be kind, because we don't want people being cruel with us. We treat them kindly. And when we do that, we have fulfilled God's law. The summation, the essence of God's law. A unique and extraordinary aspect of Jesus' love. This is so good. I think this is good. It's also really good because this is not my material. This is really good because this is good gospel material. One of the most beautiful aspects of Jesus is that he doesn't treat you and me the way we deserve. He treats us, his love is the kind of love he deserves. He treats us with the humility and the grace and with the honor that he deserves, and he gives that to us. He goes far above and beyond what he's asking us to do, and he does that generously because that's the kind of God that he is. Secondly, which path does Jesus expect his disciples to choose? Which path? There is two paths to choose. And Jesus is saying, hey, you're all walking with me. Come and follow me. And you're hearing me speak, preach, and teach. And I want to help you picture this. If you want to walk with me, you have to pick the narrow path. Choose the narrow path. And in fact, he says, there's going to be two ways that these paths are going to show themselves. You can enter God's kingdom only through the narrow gate. The highway to hell is broad. Its gate is wide for the many who choose that way. But the gateway to life is very narrow. The road is difficult, and only a few ever find it. So these two ways that you're seeing here in what Jesus says, these two ways, it's a concept already kind of surfaced in the Old Testament. You can look right in Psalm chapter 1, and you can see that there's a way of the righteous, and there's a way of the wicked. And the way of the righteous is someone who delights in God's law. They bear fruit, and they prosper. And the way of the wicked are blown away like chaff in the wind. Two separate ways to approach life. Jesus says there's two gates. In those two gates, there's two roads, there's two destinations, and there's two crowds. And every adult life, ours, is facing the choice. Which of these paths? Which one and which way am I going to choose? Now, one way you might picture this is, any of you remember Barnes & Noble? Do you remember bookstores? I used to love to, doesn't matter. Imagine being in Barnes & Noble. Imagine that. Can you picture that, some of you? Picture being, or whatever bookstore is your favorite bookstore, being in the library, right? Imagine this, that here's what Jesus is telling us. You see that over there? There's a section there. Those are the Jesus books, okay? Then, here's how you can kind of picture the world. There's those Jesus books compared to and in contrast all the other books. So, you can browse around all the other books, but those are the second, subsequent, separate path from the Jesus path. So picture yourself when the bookstore was at, we had the bookstore in Destiny when it came. Remember when Destiny was Carousel and Carousel had a big bookstore, and was it not two stories? What was the name of that? Borders. God rest its soul. Ponderosa, God rest its soul. Ground Round? Chuck E. Cheese? Nope, still open. Still open. One comedian said, Chuck E. Cheese would be like calling Blockbuster. How do I shut down? And it can't shut down. Stays open for 30 years. Still open, can't shut down, even though the... So that bookstore, massive, right? Several stories. We were at one in the Inner Harbor, Barnes & Noble's, I think, at the Inner Harbor. Several stories of books and everywhere. Imagine, here's what Jesus is saying. As you're reading and studying and growing, and you're thinking of philosophy, and you're thinking of physics, and you're thinking of science, and you're thinking of education, and you're thinking of self-help, there is every other book is in one category. That's one path. Then there's a whole other category. It's my category. It's the me category. It's the Jesus books. That's the category, and those are the contrasting choices that we have. All of the world's information separate from, there's a Jesus path to choose from. And I've spent a lot of time, perhaps you have too, spent a lot of your life wandering around the bookstore, pulling one off the shelf. Let me try this for a while. Oh, what about this author? What about this celebrity? What about this guru? What about this scientist? Whatever. And I certainly don't mean to diminish or minimize the sciences and education, all that. I hope you don't hear me saying that. I'm simply saying, if you are trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my life? Here's what Jesus says. You can get lost over here and never find life and peace with God and joy despite the circumstances. But if that's what you need, that's what you're looking for, you are going to find it by one single narrow path. But the hard part, Jesus describes. The hard part is there is a highway to hell. Now, this whole time I thought this was a song by a heavy metal band. But it's not. These are Jesus' words. He titled that song. There's a highway to hell, right? With a wide gate. John Stott, phenomenal author, scholar, teacher, commentator, he said, this gate leading to the easy way is wide, for it is a simple matter to get on that easy road. It's a simple matter. There is evidently no limit to the luggage we can take with us. We can leave nothing behind, not even our sins. We need to leave nothing behind, not even our sins, our self-righteousness, or our pride. We can take all that with us on that path. There's a broad road. This broad road that Jesus is talking about is easy. There's room. It's spacious. Life decisions are driven by the lust of the eyes. I want more of what I see. Life decisions are driven by lust of the flesh. I want more of what I feel. Life decisions are driven by the pride of life. I want more glory. In other words, I live to expand and I live to enjoy my own glory. And it essentially sounds like this: God, just leave me alone. Leave me alone. Where did we hear that? Adam and Eve, who basically said to their creator, who they were in union with and in perfect relationship with, we got this. We're going to do our own thing. We're going to live by our own rules. It's possible for me to govern my own life. Leave me alone. That's the wide path. That's the highway to hell. That path is broad. It is wide. And keep in mind, John Stott also adds this, plenty of room on this road for diversity of opinions and laxity of morals. He says, it is a road of tolerance and permissiveness. It has no curbs or boundaries of either thought or action. Travelers on this road follow their own inclinations, that is, the desires of the human heart and its fallenness. superficiality, self-love, hypocrisy, mechanical religion, false ambition, slander. These things do not have to be learned or cultivated. Effort is needed to resist them. No effort is required to practice them. That is why the broad road is so easy. This road is also chosen by many. This is the easy choice, and it is the choice that the crowds choose. I don't know if you feel that way, but I can feel like there's just a handful of people that are choosing to swim upstream, do things God's way. This road, this highway to hell is a busy road, and it's crowded with pedestrians of every kind. So, am I on that road? I don't think I'm on that road, but what if I am on that road? I'm not sure I'm on that road. Well, do I make up my own rules for life? That's one way, one symptom. Is my life governed by my rules? I make them up. I live by them. I measure other people by them. Do I believe all truths are equally true? Or am I willing to say there is an absolute truth that's been revealed to us by the God who created the world? Do I spend all my money on personal comfort and convenience? Am I typically the kind of person who has to have whatever's new and popular? Now, it's easy for us all to say, that's not me, but what makes it popular is most of us do that, or many of us, so many people do. Most people, I should say, not most of us, but most people do that. Do I crave and consume primarily for instant gratification? And I only quit at excess. I only quit when there's injury. I only quit when someone or something is hurt. I only quit when it's over-the-top excess, oftentimes secretly or privately. The topic was written by, profoundly, one of my favorite authors, C.S. Lewis. If you get a chance, if you're kind of... if you like to be challenged in your thinking, look up anything by C.S. Lewis. Look what he says about this topic. One of my favorite quotes. I picked this quote up when I was in college, literally the same night that I verbally punched that guy in the face. I'm sure this is when I was, the Lord gave this to me. Not really. Indeed, listen to this. This is what C.S. Lewis says. The safest road to hell is the gradual one. It's the gentle slope. Soft underfoot. There's no sudden turnings. There's no milestones to even see it's happening. Without any signposts, I don't even know what road I'm on. C.S. Lewis says, this wide road, the highway to hell, it's loaded with people. It's so easy. Just do what everyone else is doing. Rule and run your own life. And when God comes knocking, you just say, leave me alone. I'm submitting to no one and nothing. I'm doing my own thing. But the gateway to life is very narrow, and the road is difficult, and only a few ever find it. This road leads to life, even the eternal, not just the eternal life, but life with God right now. The one that we get to experience now, which is perfected in the world to come, right now we get to enjoy and reflect God's glory. This road is very narrow, it's tight. It's clearly marked with boundaries and guardrails. John Stott says we have to look for it to find it. It doesn't reveal itself easily. It's very easy to miss. In order to enter it, we must leave everything behind. We leave our sin, our selfish ambition. We leave our coveting, even family and friends at times, if necessary. We cannot follow Christ unless we have first denied ourselves. The entry is also a turnstile. What does that mean? It has to be entered one by one because it's so narrow. It's a difficult road. It's uncomfortable. And it's, in fact, it's uncomfortable for its selflessness or its unselfishness. There's sometimes painful terrain. John Stott says that this revealed truth that comes from God imposes limitations on us. This revealed truth that comes from God imposes limitations on what Christians may believe. And his revealed goodness, his own goodness that we see, it has its limitations on how we may behave. And in a sense, that becomes hard for us or more challenging. And then Jesus says, only a few ever find it. Very few. It is exclusive and elusive. It's hard to find. It's unpopular road. It's not easily found. And I often wonder, sometimes I come across people in kind of loving them and leading them and maybe at times counseling them, and I find people who are really struggling because in their family they feel like they're all alone. They have made some decision to respond, to believe and receive Jesus, and as time goes on, they feel more and more like, I think that I am the odd one out. We have a family, and the only one who doesn't really kind of click in and it doesn't resonate and isn't included on the family text seems to be me. Is it because I'm the Christian? This would fit what Jesus is teaching, that there are times when your own family and you feel like you're the only one on the road and you feel like you're the only one who's gone through that gate and you're looking for other family members to kind of at least honor and respect your own belief, and they don't. It would be consistent with Jesus saying, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. How can you find this path? This path, this is so important. This is so important. This path is Jesus himself. This path is not, as you know, this path is not a church. It's not an experience. It's not a handful of Christian books. It's not particular movies. It's not a particular morality. It is, in fact, a person of Jesus. And all other paths and all other books at Barnes & Noble are a dead-end path, leading to a dead end. And so we get the invitation by Jesus today to turn around. Whoever enters through me will be saved. Whoever enters through me, not through the church doors, not through, again, Christian newsletters or signing up for Christian books subscription or what have you. So, according to Jesus, there's only two ways, easy way and hard way. There's no middle way. According to Jesus, you enter by two gates. There's a wide gate and there's a narrow gate. There's no other gate. We don't have to look for other gates. It's traveled by two different crowds. There's a large crowd and there's a small crowd. There's no neutral group. That's fascinating. You could do a study on that just alone. You could study. Jesus is not making a distinction that there's a third group. Undecideds, kind of Christian, kind of on the path, kind of not. It ends in two destinations, destruction and life. There's no third alternative, also important to notice in this teaching from Jesus. And to deviate from the middle way is to risk being dubbed an extremist or a fanatic, of course. That's what the draw is to the middle, right? All the other, either other road is extreme or fanatic. So what do we do now? Let's reflect on your life rule. Think about, what's your life rule? How do I run my life? How do I decide and determine the way that I treat people? Do I just go by impulse, natural instinct, natural response, or I like to use the word retaliation? Is that my life rule? Whatever it is that flows easiest and natural. I know what flows easiest and natural for me, and I wonder if you're the same way. What flows easiest and natural for me is a little self-righteousness, a little condemnation, a little fear and anger and punishment and retribution. Or I look at my life rule and I say to myself, what's driving the way I treat people, especially the difficult people in my life? Is it humility and grace? Is it driving me to want to and desire and to do the long lifetime, sometimes lifelong work of forgiveness? That kind of reaction is so unnatural that we have to draw on and depend the Holy Spirit that was left for us and in us, those who belong to Jesus, in order to help us do what Jesus is telling us to do, to let your life be driven by those things. And if you've noticed in your life that there is more and more trouble, that as time goes on, there's more chaos, you feel more estranged to people, you're more and more full of constant conflict, it's possible that you're not following Jesus' one life rule on how to treat people, because the way we treat people is generating more estrangement and conflict at times. Peter says, don't repay evil for evil. Peter says, don't retaliate with insults when people insult you. Instead, pay them back with a blessing, right? Bring them happiness. That's what God has called you to do, and he will grant you his blessing. You will be happy as you learn to do that. So, secondly, what now? If you're following Jesus, don't be surprised when your path gets uncomfortable, difficult, or unpopular. If your path is uncomfortable, difficult, or unpopular, it could very well be. Now, it may be that, you know, we're making decisions that are bringing added chaos into our lives because of our own sinful choices, but it's possible the discomfort, difficulty, and unpopularity is a sign that your path that you're trying to follow is pretty narrow because you're with Jesus, in Jesus, doing it his way, and things have not been easy. I mean, I think of ways of, if you're raising a family and running a business or trying to educate your kids and it's uncomfortable, difficult, and unpopular, that's probably because you're following Jesus along the way. I wanted to point your attention to our a podcast that Pastor Yon and I do. It's called The Salted Podcast. And if you scan this and scroll all the way down to the bottom of the webpage, you'll see a way to link over to our podcast. We're currently in a mini-series called Is Comfort Killing Me, My Family, and My Faith? Is comfort killing? No, it's kind of the idea that if I'm living on this wide road and everything is so comfortable and easy, is it possible that I'm just kind of undermining my own faith? And lastly, one last thing to think about. If you're not following Jesus, but looking for life now and life eternal, don't forget Jesus. He claims he himself is the narrow way. It's not going to be discovered in other philosophies, secular humanism, the sciences, and so on. All of that is in God's plan to lead you to Jesus, but it isn't an end in itself. Start discovering Jesus today. If that's you and you would like to do more discovering, we have a giveaway on the way out. You can pick up a book called The Essential Jesus. You can also order something from our resource shelf. There's actually a section of that resource shelf. GoYo is Grow on Your Own Bookshelf. And we have all kinds of books that you can get started as a new believer or someone who's potentially curious about what do new believers in Jesus do or believe. There's a whole segment of books there that'll help you discover who is this Jesus? What is this one narrow gate path? And then it's possible that some of you need some encouragement while you're suffering in the difficult and narrow path that is following Jesus, and it has not been easy. People, diagnosis, conflict, sudden circumstances that have altered your life, and the path is getting difficult, staying on the path that God has put you on. You have some elements nearby you. If you would grab those, every once a month we celebrate communion together. And by celebrating communion, I mean that we obediently do what Jesus has asked us to do, which is when you are together, routinely remember why you're together. Routinely remember what it is that sets you apart and makes you a family. And we receive this from Jesus, and he says, when you're together with other believers, I don't want you to forget who this is about. This is about me. I don't want you to forget how you have come to know me. You have come to know me by the blood of Jesus and by his broken body. We haven't come to know Jesus because we have achieved a certain level of moral victories or morality, or we've raised our standard high enough. We haven't performed and behaved well enough to impress God. Instead, everything in our nature, the sinful nature, all of the self-centered, self-absorbed, leave me alone kinds of things we do before God deserves death. But there's a gift. And that gift is a gift of life. Well, what are we going to do with death? That death has been satisfied. Jesus has died the death, and he imputes that. He gives us that. He kind of, like, by faith, he says, that my death is going to count in your place. Substitution. And you have to live a perfect life. And then you say, well, I was just told, and I think I'm grasping this, I can't live a perfect life. I don't know how, and I never will, and I never have. Good news. The perfect, moral, upright, innocent, infinitely innocent life of Jesus by faith is joined to you and is applied to your life. When God sees you, he sees that Jesus has died a death in your place, and he sees that he has lived your life in your place. So what do we have to do? What are we left to do? How do we make this work where we're born again, our heart is regenerated, and we kind of come to Jesus? We simply say, I trust that Jesus, his work, death, and life is enough. I don't have to add anything to it. It is sufficient. And that by his grace, he joins us to his own son. He saves our soul. He brings our heart to life. And he takes that heart of stone and flesh that lived for itself and its own glory, and he replaces it with a new one. And that new one starts to get tender to what he desires and who he is and what he's asking of us. And that tenderness means our heart has come alive, and there's a Holy Spirit saying, I'm going to empower you to walk with me and to face everything that you're facing. You're going to do it with me now. How do I get there? It's not overperforming and grabbing God's attention. It is saying, he bled and he was beaten. And it should have been me, but it was him. I'm going to receive that by faith. You can do that today. You can receive that by faith. You're not signing up to attend our church. You're not signing up to be evangelical. You're not signing up for our perfect behavior the rest of your life, or even healthy, helpful behavior the rest of your life. You're simply saying, I see it. God has opened my eyes. I believe it, and I'm going to receive this for myself. And when you receive it for yourself, you don't just get saved from sin, you get saved into a life with a new family, a new faith family. Out of aloneness and isolation into community. And that community gets together on a regular basis and says, it's because of Jesus. This is what our communion is. It's because of Jesus. You've got those elements in your hand. I expect that you get those opened up. And here's what Jesus said. On the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread and he gave thanks to God for it. Then he broke it in pieces and he said, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this to remember me. Would you receive that body today? If you belong to Jesus, you're remembering that it was his body that was broken instead of yours. In the same way, he took the cup of wine after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant between God and his people. It's an agreement that's confirmed with my blood. Do this to remember me as often as you drink it. For every time you eat this bread and you drink this cup, you are announcing the Lord's death until he comes again. Would you receive that symbol together with your faith family? We have a team of people that are going to make themselves available to you to pray. And I would like to invite you. Here's a couple things I want you to think about. I would love to invite you to let somebody pray with you and help you take your first step onto the narrow path with and following Jesus. With and following Jesus. To say, I was on a wide path headed for destruction, and I could feel it, I sense it, I know it, and today I'm seeing it clearly. And you today sense the power to respond. Let somebody pray with you. Secondly, I want to invite those of you who are on the narrow path, and it is a difficult path. You sense its narrowness, you sense its difficulty, you sense its unpopularity, and you maybe even at times sense its loneliness. I invite you to make your way to the front and let somebody put their mustard seed faith together with your mustard seed faith and believe that God is a mountain-moving God. He can do it. He can heal your marriage. He can heal your identity. He can heal your body. He can heal your mind. He is able to do it. And while he's at work doing that healing, sometimes he starts by bringing healing to our soul, peace to our soul, while he's working out all of the hardship. Would you stand with me, church family? We're going to sing a song of joy and remembrance, and I would love for you to make your way out of your seats and let us pray for you.